With a unique design and construction, DNA Guitars is a clear choice when looking for the all-around guitar. DNA Guitars' recipe for creating perfect instruments is steeped in tradition while looking toward the future. DNA's recessed bridge construction is a five-point contact bridge, a solid brass bridge that is inset into the body, maximizing strength, contact, and string vibration. An incredibly comfortable guitar to play, DNA Guitars molds to your body, and the neck profiles are wonderful to play across. DNA uses an exclusive 100% solderless wiring harness that is designed for guitars with single coil or humbucker setup. Looking for versatility? Look no more. Check out DNA Guitars. Go to dnaguitarcompany.com. Custom guitars handcrafted in the USA. DNA Guitars. Innovation to fuel your inspiration. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 105 of Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to all things guitar, dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but you should, and today is one of those. Today, we're going to talk to an incredibly talented guitar player by the name of Tom Caulfield. This is an old interview, and we finally are getting to air it. He is a really interesting guitar player, and matter of fact, if you start to listen right here in the background, you'll be able to hear some of his work. Many people say to me, you know, hey, you don't cover enough acoustic guitar players on the show. So we are definitely trying to make more of an effort to do that and create a balance. We're always looking to strike a balance. Folks, don't forget guitarradioshow.com. And guitarradioshow@gmail.com. I want to thank everybody who tuned in to the Pat Travers episode, episode 104, last episode. A huge response to that. And thank you very, very much. I think you're really going to enjoy my conversation with Tom. He is an incredibly interesting guitar player and very talented and very soulful. Also wanted to remind you that this Thursday, tomorrow, this episode comes out episodes come out every Wednesday for Guitar Radio Show. But tomorrow, Thursday, we will have the latest installment of 500 Words with Adam P. Hunt. Adam, formerly of Premier Guitar Magazine, now writing with us on guitar documentaries. And he picked some pretty interesting ones. Ones that... little left of center, a little different, a little interesting, and stuff that I haven't seen that I'm going to be looking for now. Once again, folks, we have a whole bunch of really cool episodes coming up in the future. We've got a really interesting, as we get ready for NAMM 2016, a really interesting conversation that Adam, Steve Cohn, and I have about Gibson guitars. And what we've seen of late, and what we're hoping for the future, and we'll see when 2016 NAMM comes along. But we speculate. So that's an interesting conversation. We have Greg Howe coming up. We have Joel Danzig, formerly of Hammer Guitars, and now with Danzig Guitars coming up. And a whole bunch of other people that I can't tell you about because it's not in the can yet, but there's some real great surprises coming all the way through 2016. That's about it. We're going to get right to it now. But be sure that when you listen to the show, and if you listen to it on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or any of the other venues that the show airs on, please rate and review the show. That would be really helpful. But always go to guitarradioshow.com because in the show notes, there's usually a ton of video, pictures, and interesting information about the artist or gear maker that we're covering. In the meantime, we're going to get moving and start our interview with Mr. Tom Caulfield. You ready? Guitar Radio Show, guitarradioshow.com. right, folks, I am very happy and pleased to have a guitarist with a pure approach and a rare musical spirit, Mr. Tom Caulfield. Welcome to Guitar Radio Show. How are you?
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Folks, you can go to CaulfieldMusic.com to learn everything there is to learn about Tom. You can check out his new record, which just came out in May. It's called Things I Heard While in the Womb, and I have questions about that. It just came out in May. You can get it on iTunes, CD Baby, Amazon, and where other downloadable items are sold.
Retailers everywhere.
Yeah, retailers everywhere, worldwide. So, Tom, it's so cool to have you on here, and I got to tell you, after sitting down, I mean, I know some of your older stuff, and hearing the new record, which just came out in May, there's three tracks on this record, and they're these, essentially, they're like opuses, or two opuses with a interlude in between.
Right.
And I was fascinated when I heard it because it was, this is a bit of a departure for you.
Yeah, it is. It is. I've made four records that were very kind of austere, very spacious, just the guitar. The inspiration for those kind of was I'd wanted to make just guitar music for a while. I'd been making some pop music for a few years and just felt it was a real calling for me. It kept calling to me. And years before, I had been up in Santa Cruz and I was waiting for a ride. A friend was picking me up. We both got off work. And there was a guy in an archway, a street musician, and he was just playing a nylon string guitar in an archway, and the concrete was making it reverberate. Mm-hmm. Just in the most gorgeous way. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of filed it away in my head that I said, you know, I'd love to pursue that. And so, you know, when I bought a nylon string guitar, that was the idea. And so I did that, but I always really believe in kind of the Zen phrase, beginner's mind. And mm-hmm. so I like to always kind of start anew because I think then you have a fresh feeling about it. So since I'd always been a fan of certain prog things and what have you, I decided to expand the palette this time and go for more length.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not even just about the length. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's definitely a departure, but also the actual approach, too, is a little different. The instrumentation is different as well.
Yeah, I started to want to just see if I could get a lot of things that I've always loved in music into it without changing what I do. That's the challenge. And I was just doing guitar records with not much else adornment. The third record has a little cello on it, but I love, you know, I'm a big fan of so much, and so I loved the musically suggestive phrases of Wayne Shorter and Miles Davis. I loved the real extended pastoral pieces of Mike Oldfield, such as Omadhon, mm-hmm. and his real Celtic guitar things, very mm-hmm. bucolic. And I loved extended compositions. And I also just liked the idea of improvisation, which I really hadn't done yet. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to see if I could get those all in, but maintain my fingerprint. And that's the idea. There's a great aesthetic ideal, which basically says to try to get variety out of unity, to keep, you know, or you can even flip it around, unity and variety. But the idea is that, you know, it can go a lot of places, but it's all cut of the same cloth. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge I set to myself mm-hmm. for this new one. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty pleased with it.
So what's the significance between, or what's the significance of, I should say, the title of the record, Things I Heard While in the Womb?
You know, that came from probably two sources. The first one was I was thinking a lot about where this music comes from, because probably just like all guitar composers, you know, it just starts with the idea start with kind of messing around, and then one of them has a sound that sounds closer to, you know, resonates with a feeling that you have, mm-hmm. and those are the ones you go with because they seem to have a little more truth to them. And I was just really reaching for these real core emotions, these real primal things that reminded me of kind of my earliest days, boyhood, mm-hmm. where I grew up. It was real pastoral and bucolic. Which was in southeastern Michigan. And so it wasn't really all the way back to the womb, but it was a long way back. And so I just started figuring out I seemed to want to kind of make a record that was an homage to that kind of pastoral bucolic boyhood I had, where we, you know, played catch in a lot of farmers' fields and caught a lot of frogs and ponds and what have you. And it was funny because I read John Steinbeck's East of Eden when I was very young. Have you read that by any chance?
No, I have not.
Well, I don't know why I was drawn to it when I was young, but it paralleled how I felt when I was young, because he just kind of poeticizes the landscape in it. And it, mm-hmm. even though I probably wasn't understanding it on a lot of levels, I did seem to absorb that. So I always found myself kind of responding to those kind of pastoral moods. Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened. So it was reaching way back like that. And then just coincidentally, I was reading something about the reason why sounds that are echoey or reverby are comforting is perhaps that's because that's the way we hear things when we are in the womb. Mm. And I thought, you know, I made the connection that I use a lot of echoes and a lot of reverbs. And so I put those two ideas together and thought it was a nice title.
That's I never even thought about that. That makes so much sense that it would be, that's why it's so appealing to us. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, when I first read that, I wasn't even sure if that whole science was true. And so I read a little more about it. And of course, there's a lot about that yes, we are hearing things in the womb. Mm-hmm. Yes, they're very distant. Mm-hmm. And the Beth Reithen quote I read was that someone said it's the first evidence we have that there's a world beyond us, other than just us, mm-hmm. where we separate to putting our attention on something outside. And I thought that was interesting as well.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's funny because now hearing all of that, when I look at the titles of the songs on the record, now they make even more sense to me.
Yeah. the first piece is just like a floating in water, as you know. Mm-hmm. And it's very, it kind of has those two explosive, very positive moments. And then there's the kind of reverie in the middle. And then the other one is kind of the dark. Mm-hmm. The dark heart, where you kind of enter the real world,
right.
And all its attendant jagged edges.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very loose concept.
Yeah. One time I was talking to Pat Metheny one time, and I asked him about titles, and he had said that he wished. I don't know if he feels this way now. This was a long time ago, but he had wished that he didn't have to title songs. He doesn't mind titling records so much, but he didn't like titling songs because he felt that in many respects it would give the listener a predetermined meaning of the song in many respects. And he didn't always like that. How do you feel about that?
You know, I like titling songs. Mm-hmm. I like the challenge of it. I love language. I'm a big reader, and I understand the impulse that he's suggesting. A lot of times when I'm beginning a collection and the pieces are still very pure, I think of some of these brave records I've seen come out where the person has just named the song. You know, each song has a different color for the name, or I think the Aphex Twin record had nothing, or just they were all named, you know, they were just numbers or something. And I kind of get it because it's pure, but you know, a title that's just a number is in the end a title as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's sort of, how would you say it? It says, it says something by omission that makes it a little clinical to me, or mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. So to me, I try to come up with titles generally that are somewhat poetic in the sense that they don't label it, yeah. and they don't certainly preach a point or try to make a, you know, have an agenda, mm-hmm. but they just maybe lay out a set of images that's maybe somewhat open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of enjoy the challenge of that.
yeah.
That's my take. That's well, kind of how I approach it.
Yeah, and your music is, I mean, is very visual. So there's yeah. there's a visual component to the music you make. So I think the words are
real evocative. I look at my whole body of work as a giant canvas that I'll work on from the beginning to the end. And to me, the words are a great way to just kind of add to the overall vibe. And when I look at the titles as I'm finishing a record, I often try to balance it. If there's, say, 9 titles, I look at them and I try to think of the avenues of life, and I hope there's a few that are maybe a little philosophical and a few that are just everyday life phrases, mm-hmm. and maybe a few that are a little technical or scientific,
mm-hmm.
Some that are maybe real accessible, some that are maybe inscrutable, and I go for a balance of phrases, and I hope that they're colorful and evocative phrases that contribute to the canvas, you know, the vibe that you're getting from the youth.
Yeah, I think you hit it. I think you hit it. I was curious to know, and I ask this of almost everyone who comes on this show, you're born in Michigan. What kind of influence, growing up where you grew up, what kind of influence did that have on you in regards to your playing and your maturation as a player?
Yeah, it has a lot to do with what I mentioned a few minutes ago. It was real rural where I grew up, mm-hmm. and to my surprise, and I think it might be a bit of a reaction, that as time goes on, I more and more reach back to trying to use my guitar to make kind of musical impressions of the way the summer times and the winter times felt when I was very young. You know, the first 10, 12 years when we would toboggan or catch fireflies or swim in the ponds, hang out in the farm fields. There were suburbs, of course, around, and of course, you know, pop music was in the air. So we were concentrating probably more superficially on the radio and things. And so that's probably more where my head was back then. But as time goes by, and especially now that I live in a big city, it could be a bit of a, kind of a longing to recapture that a little bit, or, that innocence. But mm-hmm. I find more and more that these pieces will respond to me that feel like that rural, bucolic kind of landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the main influence it had, and I think I hear the same thing a little bit in what Mike Oldfield does with the acoustic guitar,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to think if there's any other influences, but that would be it, just the kind of rural landscape, and I see myself reach for that a lot when I construct melodies and phrases.
Right, and what about people in your life growing up? Was there a guitar influence in your life? Either friend, family, or a particular guitar player out there in the world that was the reason you picked it up, or?
Yeah, the first experience I probably had was with Christmas carols, mm-hmm. and my mother could play them very rudimentarily, first on a ukulele. And then she had just a real cheap nylon string guitar. And to this day, that's what I kind of hear most in my songs, is almost kind of a Baptist hymn kind of thing to my to my melodies that's simple and sort of very diatonic, you know. And then when I took lessons, I had a teacher that taught me very simplified kind of Andrew Segovia pieces, mm-hmm. and I got a book of arrangements of his things, very, you know, simplified for a beginner. And so it was those very kind of gypsy, Hungarian kind of Spanish-ish pieces that I was learning as a kid that really kind of sunk into me a lot. And then, then there was all the pop guitars, and I just really responded to the folk, you know, guitar accompaniments of the first James Taylor record, mm-hmm. as I've mentioned a couple times, Mike Oldfield's records. I loved his acoustic. But probably one of the most influential pieces to me was Song of the Wind by Santana off Caravan Sarai. Do you know the piece by?
No, I don't. I have to go back and look at that now.
Oh, it's a great album, and it's a 6-minute guitar solo, but it has such definition of phrasing that you can, after a few listens, you can sing the whole solo along mm-hmm. with him, because mm-hmm. each phrase is almost a melody hook unto itself. Mm-hmm. And I was just used to love it, and I learned it note by note. And to me, it remains an ideal for a solo guitar piece. So that he was a big influence. Mm-hmm. And there's other big guitar influences. I think I really admired the very concise economic phrasing of the guitarists on the Steely Dan records. Mm-hmm. They were, I was a big fan.
Yeah, so and, like Larry Carlton. And
yeah.
Yeah.
So, some of those things.
Did you play electric much or early days? Or?
Yeah, sure. I played pop music, you know, as a kid, and I was in, you know, the requisite high school bands and whatnot.
Right.
And then there was a band in Ohio called the Raisin Band, and they went on to become Adrian Belew's Bears.
Oh yeah.
And I was with that band when we met Adrian, and he enjoyed us quite a bit, and he would join us on stage. Mm-hmm. And then I left after a while because I wanted to compose my own stuff, and he kind of continued on with them, and they ended up forming the Bears. This would have been in the late 80s, about the time I made a pop record for a small label called Passport. And I was an electric guitar. I was kind of always both.
Right.
But it was acoustic that I started focusing on exclusively about 6 years ago.
Well, there's a question I have for you now. You're a solo artist for the most part, right? I mean, when you go out and you do these particular tracks, when you go out and play these live, are you employing loopers at all, or?
I do. I use a loop machine. I've been using the Digitech Jam Man, uh-huh. and it's a pretty good piece of gear to use for what I do because it's simple. But there's a handful of my tracks, my pieces that I play solo. So I usually open my show with 4 or 5 solo pieces, and then I'll bring the looper in a little bit, because as you're noting, a lot of my pieces are kind of duets or mm-hmm. trios. There's 2 or 3 guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'll have a loop with never more than 1 guitar, and a few of the pieces I'll just create the loop on stage and perform to it there. And then some of them, I've got a couple pre-recorded tracks because they're whole, you know, verse, chorus, bridge pieces, and I don't want to have the audience sit through me create the, you know, the backing track. But it's funny because I go back and forth about whether I feel good about using the loop box. So I try to do as much as I can solo, but it's actually okay.
Well, you know, I'm really impressed by what people are doing with that particular effect. Some people, I've heard some people say, oh, it's a cheat. And I'm like, you know, this is essentially what Les Paul was building when he created the Les Pulverizer, you know.
Yeah.
And essentially that's what the looper is. And, you know, he created it so people could be creative. And that's the point, you know. So I think it's just, you know, Les used to say all the time, these are tools. Don't get caught up in the in the politics of it. It's a tool.
Yeah, or if you know use it badly or not, there's if you use it well, it can be wonderful. So, and it's also one of those subjective things. I've had gigs where I'm playing and I'll overhear a guy say to his date or his buddy, you know, he'll say he's cheating or something. He's doing something's going on up there. He's not actually playing what we hear or something, you know. And I'll kind of wince and feel like I'm doing what he just said or bad or bad about it or something. Well, and then other times, you know, guys will be very enchanted or just lay people that don't care about equipment or like you say, the politics of guitaring and just hear a very rich sound and just enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I try to make my loops real unobtrusive. I mean, they're just usually the ones that are pre-made are just very simple, you know, understated performances of the backing track.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the fireworks happens with what I'm usually playing live,
right.
You know, with the forefront, the melody. And then, as I say, I kind of bridge the gap, a good deal by playing at least a third of my set just solo. And then I also create the loops live, which usually anybody finds kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's one of the things that's always kind of frustrated me over the years is the cynicism of a lot of players. You know, it's like, you know, we're all here to make music, and we're all here to share music, and we're all going to make music in the way that we find it the best way for us to share it and put it over. So, you know, I don't understand when people get themselves all in a twist over it.
I know what you mean. I mean, as if there's like a purist idea that if you're not toughing out some kind of level. I mean, even if I played as twice as good as I know how to or something, I still couldn't be two guitars because I'm actually doing, you know, very deep nut position chords and then high leads in a lot of sections.
Right.
And I think another way of saying what you're saying is, I go into a gig wanting people to hear a really beautiful sound, you know? And so it's not, my sound has never been about a display of chops, fireworks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I can play faster and more complicated than I have on any of my records yet, but I personally, when I go to music to listen to it, except every now and then, maybe driving or with headphones or what have you, I like music that's a little slower with a lot of space and where the melody and the emotion is what's at the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe secondarily, it would be I like a richness of tone. I like great, rich stereo reverbs. I like, you know, well-dialed-in EQs with a thick, nice, fat bottom but with no woof, a creamy high-end but not, you know, sibilant and tinny. So, yeah, I mean, I put great amounts of energy into making sure that's happening, you know, so it's not like I'm just trying to find the fastest way to, you know, to play my gig or something. I'm just trying to kind of make the best way.
Yeah.
And if I had another player with me, we'd have to charge more money or we'd have to have a, you know, a logistics situation that's more difficult. And so, to me, looping works, and I don't have much guilt at all about it.
Mm-hmm. No, and I don't think you should. You know, it's funny because in my notes, I have you down here. I wrote here, your music is music for music's sake.
Well, thank you. I like that.
You know, and it's there's a lot of purity to it. And that's what really was captivating me about it. You know, I really like that.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Let's talk about your guitars.
Yeah,
because I'm always fascinated. I'm, you know, I have several acoustic guitars. I'm a big electric guitar guy, as everybody knows. But I have several acoustic guitars, and I'm really fussy about acoustic guitars because I don't think there's a whole lot of sense in having a really poorly made acoustic guitar. Because there's no hiding. You can't hide.
No, there's not. That's funny that you say that because this might be getting a little ahead, but having my guitar kind of worked on a year and a half ago, and it was crazy because I was having this intonation problem, and I don't know if you've ever had the issue with the second string, and because its overtone cycle is a step less than the rest, it can play a little sharp, a little flat. Mm-hmm. And I was trying modified nuts, and I was sanding the saddle. And the guitar tech was one of the best in town, and finally he was exasperated because, he was having trouble fixing a simple issue of the intonation of a B string. And finally he figured out that I always tune a step down. And he said, oh, you mean all this time you tune a step down? And I said, yeah, does that matter? And he said, yeah, that definitely matters.
Oh, yeah.
And so once he did the work on it, was it a step down? Because I love that loose strings.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you on that.
And then it all worked out.
So, wonderful.
you can't be playing a guitar that's fighting you.
So you tune a whole step down.
I tune a whole step down all the time. I can't even remember the last time I tracked or played anything at regular E tuning. It's always down at D.
See?
D and D straight tuning, but at D and dad gad from C up. In other words, a whole nother step down.
Right.
Are the tunings I use all the time.
So what gauge strings are you using?
You know, I just started using a new kind. I use D'Addario 12 to 50, 11 to 52 for the longest time. I think they're called Slight and Phosphorus Bronze. And I liked them, but I never liked the 11 for the E string, the high E. It was always kind of thin. So I wanted it to be thicker. So at the same time, people have been imploring me to try Elixir strings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know Elixir, right?
Sure.
Yeah. So I went on, onto the site, Sweetwater, and was looking at Elixir and just noticed that they had developed a different gauge kind of spectrum with Taylor. And it started at 13, and then it stayed at the same gauges in the middle and then got a little deeper at the bottom. So I tried those, and I just loved them.
Huh.
So I love a light set with a little bit of a thicker high E.
That's interesting. And that gives you the opportunity to go ahead and tune down a whole step, and then in your open tunings, another whole step.
Yeah, yeah, and it just keeps the highest note, because as you hear, my melodies go from the very bottom of the guitar to the very top, and it keeps the high notes very deep and stout and creamy instead of getting plucky and thin.
Mm-hmm.
So, we should say, we're talking the steel string here. I use both nylon and steel.
Right.
We've been talking all about the steel string.
Right. So let's go through those guitars. Tell me about the steel string first.
Yeah, well, the steel string guitar is just my love of my life right after my gal. And it's a 92 J45, Gibson J45.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, 1992 was the first year Gibson opened a plant in Montana.
Yep.
I hope I have that right.
Yep, that's the plant.
And they had been making them all over the place, and things had gotten kind of scattered. Mm-hmm. And the J45 has a crazy history of, like so many things, Fender's, various stories of Fender guitars and CBS and what have you. What happened in a very, let me keep it to a nutshell. I was working at a music store, and a very, very elderly man came in with his son. And I had been trying to decide what acoustic guitar to buy, to see, and I couldn't. They all have their virtues, and I was looking at small Martins and Guilds and what have you. And he came in, and he had a beat-up J45 from the 30s, and it was warped, and it was cracked, and he was a very, very elderly man. So we took it back to the tech, which was a friend of mine, Denny Lash, and he said, yeah, he could get it working. And I talked to the son a while, and the son said that the older man had wanted to seriously pursue a career as a guitarist and a vocalist, but got called up for the war. And when he went, the guitar went in the closet and he never really got it back out. So that was interesting to me. So Danny fixed it up and clamped it down and glued it and got the warp out and, you know, sealed the cracks. And when the two fellows came back to get the guitar, and I'm going to jump in and say I'm not much of a mystic. I mean, I'm mostly a rationalist, and I don't have a lot of supernatural stories or experiences to relate. But I pulled the guitar out, and I'm just a rudimentary guitarist when it comes to jazz. But I looked into the fellow's eyes, and he wanted to see it. He was probably 92, 94 years old or so. And I played a minor seven chord, and he started crooning. And I just kind of locked into his eyes, and this guitar sounded so rich. And he somehow I just started moving my hand, and it seemed to be following with this melody that he was singing. And I, for 50 seconds, it was one of the strangest experiences I ever had, where I was just playing, you know, flat fives and augmented chords, and I was just descending down, and he was singing some standard that I have no idea what it was. And he just kind of gave me a gentle smile, and when they left, I said, that's it, it's going to be a J45 that I get. So it was a couple of years later that I went to Gruen Guitar in Nashville, and they told me the Montana story and what have you, and pulled this guitar out, and I just loved it. Spruce top, mahogany sides, rosewood neck, very standard J45. And I have an album out right before this record. It was called Tales from the Wine Dark Sea. And it's the first record I did on the J45, because the first three were nylon string. And I really wanted to capture it in all its glory. And we did. As a matter of fact, I didn't want to record it at home, because I have to use dynamic mics at home to minimize street noise. I wanted to use, you know, great German condenser mics and great preamps. So I went out to a good studio in L.A. and just captured it in stereo. And I'm real proud of that record for that reason. If anything else, it captures the J45 once and for all about as good as it could be captured. So.
And it's interesting. It's interesting because, you know, when I heard the guitar, before I knew what you were playing, and I realized what you were playing once I visited your website, I knew by hearing it, I knew just instinctively, I was like, this is not a Martin.
Yeah. You know, Martins are so great. They're so folk. Do you own a Martin by any chance?
No, I've played many.
Yeah. I've played D45s, and to me, the D8, the 018, I think it's called. I'm not a real Martin guy.
Yeah, D18.
I know they record well because they're very small and they're very focused. For example, my guitar, you definitely need a room mic in addition for sure. Maybe you do with a Martin, I don't know. But because my guitar is very jumbo-y, you know, and a lot of where the sound's happening is once you're 6 feet away from it. Because it just fills the room. And so they'll always mic the sound hole. They'll mic, you know, right near the top of the neck. They'll mic down at the body to the right, you know, sort of the back of the body, and then a room mic. And I've seen guys work with the Martins, and it's kind of just like a Y pattern or an X pattern right near the sound hole and the neck because it's so focused. And, you know, you get that great tight focus. I mean, I would like to own one just for that sound, you know. But that's great that you could tell because, yeah, it's very distinct from that tighter focus sound that you get from a Martin.
Absolutely, yeah. There was a bigger sound. And that's always been for me is I have an Everly Brothers Gibson. And that one is, you know, that it's got that jumbo vibe to it, you know. But the sound really flies off of the spruce top, you know. Okay, so what about the nylon string?
Is really just a simple guitar. It's a Manuel Rodriguez mm-hmm. and they're made in Spain. And there's not a big story about that guitar. I'm looking at it now. The only thing there was that I went down to play them, and they had kind of their, I guess what was their entry-level model, and they had kind of their more professional model. Mm-hmm. And I had heard great things about the simpler one. And I played them both, and I personally got a better feeling from the more inexpensive guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I think I paid the grand sum of $250 for it. Mm-hmm. And the other one was, I always wonder if maybe I missed something because I hadn't been acclimated to a nylon string in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one sounded a little more closed to me. Perhaps it had more definition, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But this one just had a nice blend to it, kind of a natural reverb. And I really enjoyed it. And a few months before, I had literally been sitting in a thrift shop playing at one that they were asking for $30 for. I don't know why I didn't buy it that day, and it sounded great too. And so I thought to myself, maybe, I think I was just in a frame of mind where, you know, I was going to go with my instinct more than what the tag said, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just felt good about it, and I bought it. And what was amazing there was I was all set to go, and I was going to make this record. I just wanted to make a nylon string guitar record, which became my first one. And I got the worst flu in the world the day after I got the guitar.
Mm.
And I just was laid out. I was having to literally crawl around. And at first I thought I just wouldn't work. But I was so excited about having the guitar that I would drag it over to the bed and start playing, and I had my portable recorder to grab ideas. And I was in such physical pain that I was doing one of two things. I was either expressing that pain, or I was doing everything I could to make some kind of sound that sounded as far away from that pain as possible. And so in the end, what I had was 9 or 10 songs that worked really well as a kind of yin-yang, where 5 of them are very, very dark and, you know, pained, and the other 5 are very kind of reveries, kind of, they just float through the air, you know, kind of in a reverie of escape.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was beneficial to making a set of music, I guess, that those things happened at the same time.
Well, absolutely. I mean, talk about really laying it all on the line for your music.
Yeah. But I advise it. I do. If you ever get physically ill, start writing because it forces you out of your head.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that all the great stuff comes from feeling. I think that the mind is useful to structure things because, you know, you can't just have things go round and round in an amorphous way. You know, your mind helps you put it into verses and courses or sections, but the great, you know, phrases and motifs, I think, come from deep feeling. So,
mm-hmm.
So when you get a flu, grab your instrument. That's my advice.
I have a question now. I was wondering, do you find that your approach is different on the nylon as opposed to the steel?
Absolutely, yeah. And don't you think that plays into that symbiosis with, you know, like there's just something a little different about every guitar that makes you play a little different.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like some people just, you know, if you're not inspired, you buy an instrument and you've got mm-hmm. 10 new songs. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, the GA45, you know, what can you say about steel strings? You know, they resonate. They those strong fourths and fifths are always so addictive to hear, and those open A chords and, you know, leaving open strings and
mm-hmm. Cowboy, you know, chords.
Letting it sing. You know, the attack you use is a little more, you know, a little more. How could I say it? But yeah, with the minute I pick up the nylon string guitar, I start kind of channeling a kind of gypsy thing for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I have Hungarian and Celtic blood, so that's probably there, but probably more so it's just the lessons I had as a kid, because it was all the Volga Boatmen and, you know, simplified Brahms pieces and Dvorak pieces and, you know, all the things that that Segovia was playing.
Right.
And so I immediately, my hands just go to those forms, and I start kind of, you know, playing usually minor-based things, and then just, you know, kind of topping them with melodies and very slowly moving bass parts to other chords and things. And then I'm so saturated with pop music, I usually set it into some sort of verse chorus bridge structure. But yeah, I play darker, I play a little more passionate, and old world on the nylon string.
Mm-hmm.
And sparser, because it doesn't ring as much. So I just kind of play suggestive phrases and let them have a little more space between them. Whereas with the steel string, I play more kind of spectral and maybe more optimistic and more poignant, you know, with a lot of more pull-offs and things like that,
mm-hmm.
hammers and
mm-hmm.
pull-offs and open strings and open fourths and fifths and things.
Do you...
And I play more kind of...
Go ahead.
Minor thirds and clusters and vibrato melodies with the nylon string.
Well, yeah, it emotes in such a different way.
Right.
Especially with vibrato.
Exactly. It's a very it's very interesting. The vibrato on a steel string sounds almost what's the word, like defiant or swagger-ish. Whereas on the nylon string, it's almost passionate and almost mm-hmm. pained and a little desperate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I love vibrato on a nylon string guitar. It's one mm-hmm. of my absolute favorite things.
I agree. I agree.
To put it in melodies. You can almost get addicted. Sometimes I look at my hands when I'm playing. I realize I'm always using some vibrato to some extent. Instead of just playing flat notes, but I don't know, I vary the speed a bit, so I haven't heard anything too overdone yet. So
no, I wouldn't. I didn't think so either. So what else encompasses your live rig?
Say again.
What else is in your live rig when you're out there playing?
Oh, okay. The way my signal path goes is I have the Digitech Jamman starts, and then the very next thing that happens is MXR, that EQ we've all seen in the music shell forever, that kind of bigger MXR,
yeah.
It's 10 or 12 band EQ.
Right, the graphic EQ.
Yeah, the graphic EQ. For a long time, I didn't use it and just used the controls on the amps, but then I learned to get more specific. It takes, I'll tell you, for when you concentrate mainly on the music, it's a whole separate skill to become a good engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten into it more. When I experienced frustration, I just would turn my head away and close my eyes and hope for the best. But I finally am kind of getting to know it. And for me, that EQ is great for a couple of reasons. I like a very strong low end, but I don't like woof. And woof will also, at volume, as you know, cause feedback, low end feedback in a live setting. So woof is always living around sort of 250, and that EQ helps me dial that down.
Mm-hmm.
So if I pull that down, yet I can still keep it real strong and deep and boomy lower than that, say up or, you know, like around 70 hertz or something like that. I hope this isn't getting too technical.
No, not at all, man. We love this.
I think you have some of your audience is probably into the technical side of it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Cool. And then on the high end, I don't know when this happened. It almost sounds OCD or something, but I became very, very against anything too high-end. I like a strong, bright high-end, but I don't like any sort of sibilance and crispy and, you know, kind of hi-hat you know, kind of frequencies. Mm-hmm. So I always pull down at 20 and at 15 and even at 12, just so that it's nice and creamy and stout. I like the high end to top off around maybe 7 or 8, you know, kilohertz with a bit of air, you know, maybe somewhere. So that's what I use there, and I maybe pull it down a little at 500. So that's really beautiful. You get a somewhat scooped sound. It's strong, but it's not sibilant and it's not woofy. From there, I go to a reverb called the New Neighbor, the Stereo Wet. The brand is New Neighbor. It's a small, it's a boutique company. And it has a stereo out, which is beautiful because the chips are stereo in it, and they make the plate really rich. And it's a real simple box. It just gives you a couple options, and you can dial how long you want the tail and how deep you want the tail. And it's a real rich, clean plate, and I use that to varying degrees depending on the piece. And then I come out of that to two amplifiers that I have on stage. One is the Fender Acoustasonic, mm-hmm. with the surround speaker, which is on my left. And then I send the other side to my Vox AC15, so that's all tube. And that's where I mainly send the deeper signal, the thicker, darker signal. And the Acoustasonic is kind of the higher, the high part of the mid-range and the brighter side. And then in between the Vox and the Vox and the guitar is a Fishman preamp, which helps me dial that a little more specifically since the amps are responding a little different. So I just, I usually add a little low end there. Once again, take off some high end and sort of just set the, I sometimes reverse the phase, you know, just to get rid of feedback or what happens. And that's the setup.
That's cool. And it's pretty simple. I mean, it's not crazy. So, and you're bringing all that sound.
Yeah. It's not too crazy. It's just four pedals, two amps. The main thing is it's the stereo. That's what I love. Mm-hmm. I set them, you know, at a pretty good distance on either side, and it just the richness of the stereo reverb makes for a great sound.
Are you taking it out on the road now, or?
Well, right now I've got a residency at a coffee shop in San Pedro, which is just part of the whole LA, you know, area, mm-hmm. the LA sprawl. It's down about 30 miles, not as far as Long Beach. It's kind of the older port city before Long Beach kind of became the larger port city. But it's about a half hour away from where I live, and I play there every Sunday morning. And so that's great because I can work things out there, and regulars have come, you know, got to know my set, and it's enjoyable. And then in the other direction, north, there's a lot of winery tasting rooms. And that's worked out really well because my sound is suitable to, you know, just that environment and to socializing and setting that mood. So there's two wineries up there that I play semi-regularly. Mm-hmm. And that's been it so far. I've wanted to, you know, play a little more, but I haven't gone out of Southern California yet.
Well, so I tell you, I'd love it for you to come to Austin. That would be great.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. You know, it's quite
a
music town.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. Everything you can think of under the sun.
I know. Austin's like one of the great flowering, you know, city stories of the last 30 years in this country.
Yeah.
It was like it just exploded into this very legendary and colorful and active town.
Mm-hmm.
Except I've never been.
Oh, yeah. You owe it to yourself to come. If anything, just for the barbecue.
Yeah.
Well, Tom, I can't thank you enough for taking time out to sit and talk with us and just let us, you know, pick your brain.
Hey, it's really been enjoyable. I really, really appreciate it.
Folks, check out Tom Caulfield's new record. It's called Things I Heard While in the Womb. You can check it out on iTunes, CD Baby, Amazon, anywhere records are sold. It's his sixth release. It is a wonderful wonderful musical journey for you to take. Also, folks, go. You can check him out on Facebook and also CaulfieldMusic.com. Don't hang up right away, Tom, but we're going to sign off right here. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Okay.
Well, there you have it, folks. Really great stuff. He's a great musician and really in touch with the... he's visceral. That's the word I would use. He's got a core, and he's wonderful to listen to, and it was great to talk to him. Really, really great. So check him out. Once again, we're bringing you guitar players that you might not normally hear about, and that's the plan, you know. We want to bring you all the people that you know, but we also want you to hear about these other people because that's our mission. And same goes with the gear makers and the guitar builders and the everybody else. Meantime, we got to get out of here, but take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and keep on playing. We'll see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
I like this crowd already.
GRS Productions.